Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Space, the final frontier.
These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission, to explore strange new worlds.
Enterprise.
This is Captain Jean-Luc Picard.
Captain Janeway.
Captain Cisco.
Red alert.
Photon torpedoes, fire.
The official Star Trek podcast.
Engage.
Make it so.
With your host, Jordan Hoffman.
That, sir, is illogical.
And make sure history never forgets.
This is Engage.
Hailing frequencies open, sir.
Whoa! Listen to that excitement. Excellent. Another edition of Engage, the official Star Trek podcast, has begun. We are zooming through warp speed, and we have a big show today. We don't have any time to waste. Brian, do we have any time to waste?
No, we don't.
We have no time to waste. We got to get right into it. We have a special guest. He's here right now. Can I beam him in later?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, because I got to be honest with you. We're on deck 44, but we're in the battle bridge today.
There was a turnabout intruder in deck 44.
There was. We got bumped out of our normal recording room because somebody else was going late. And rather than wait around with our thumbs up our rear end, we said we'll record it in a separate room. So we're in the kitchen. Here, we're in the kitchen, just in the corner with a couple of microphones. No, I'm joking. But we're on the battle bridge, so let me hit the button, and through the magic of post-production, we're going to beam him in. I'm hitting the button now. Boop! And there he is right in front of me. Everyone, please applaud. Matt Singer is here today. Matt Singer, the editor-in-chief of ScreenCrush.com.
And I was already talking, though, so I might have destroyed the illusion that you beamed me in here.
Yeah, we're also recording in the kitchen, so
okay.
That's okay. We're beaming him in now. Matt Singer, a longtime friend of mine and of the internets. You've been talking about movies and writing about movies on the internet for a long time.
Yes.
Prior to your work at Screen Crush, you were working at IndieWire.
I have worked at IndieWire.
You were working at IFC.
I did. I worked at the Independent Film Channel for several years.
And before that?
The Dissolve.
The Dissolve, of course. And also, I don't know, your school newspaper, maybe?
Not really.
Well, that's enough. That's a pretty good list.
That's enough.
Screen Crush, if you don't know, is your number one destination for movie news with a, and correct me if I'm wrong, with a populist/geek bent, but not exclusive.
I think that's well said, yes.
I would say that your primary interest, and this is as you in life, are things for dorks, you know, Spider-Man, the X-Men.
I am one.
Star Wars, Star Trek.
But write what you know, as they say.
But also when the Toronto Film Festival is happening, all these snooty pants movies from Poland are coming out, you're watching those too.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Good. Well, wanted to have a movie maven on today because we are mere hours away from the first screenings of Star Trek Beyond.
Mm.
I have spoken to one person who's seen it.
Wow.
Have you talked to a person who's seen it?
Now I'm talking to you who's talked to one person. So okay. By proxy, I suppose I have. But this is the first.
Yeah. No, I'm not going to say what this person said, but you know the guy.
I do.
You know him better
than
I do.
Is it you? Are you talking about yourself in the third person?
I'm seeing it in 2 days.
Oh.
The first screenings are happening, and then next week it's out, and then everybody's going to see it. So
if I hear loud weeping in the like on the wind in 2 days, I'll know what it is.
Yes.
You will have seen Star Trek Beyond.
I'm seeing Star Trek Beyond in 2 days, and I'm incapable of disliking a Star Trek movie. The worst Star Trek movie still is... I've only seen the worst Star Trek movie I've still seen 8 times, you know, so...
And which one is that?
I'm not getting into that right now. This is a long story.
Okay, fair enough.
Let's put it this way. Star Trek Beyond can only go up.
Okay.
It can only go up.
Mm,
so
fair enough.
But, okay, so the new movie's coming out imminently. This episode is not about that. This episode is we're going to kick it back old school and talk about the first Star Trek movie. But before I do, I want to do a quick bit of This Week in Trek. And I wanted to run it by Matt Singer. Matt, you're into video games. You know what the cool kids are up to. Have you heard about this Pokemon Go?
I have heard about it, yes.
Have you played it?
I have not played it, no.
Oh, why not? I figured you would have.
I have a six-month-old daughter at home.
I got a six-month-old. I'm playing it.
Oh, Brian.
Because it's the episode The Game from Next Generation. All of society is addicted to a video game.
I have been thinking about what the sort of allegory here is.
I was thinking
kind of WALL-E. There seems like a WALL-E thing.
Because you get up and move.
You get up and move. Pokemon. I know. That's the one issue with the
That's
metaphor.
Why moms are not upset about Pokemon Go. They go, well, at least he's getting outside.
At least
outside.
He's out of the house.
But it's basically The Game from TNG. So
how did that one end?
Leffler's Laws. I don't remember. It works out in the end, I think.
Okay, so we shouldn't be worried about the imminent collapse of society.
No, but you got to work hard to make it happen. So you got to fight. You got to fight.
All right.
The other thing I wanted to bring up, I don't know if you saw this. I'm holding in my hand.
What is that?
This is a copy of Friday's Wall Street Journal.
What is a newspaper? I'm unfamiliar with this device in your hand.
Well, it's funny you say that. I don't normally read. I do like to read the print newspaper.
Uh-huh.
I would say on an average week, I used to subscribe to the New York Times, and then I stopped because I would look at the end of the week and I would just see dead forests in the corner. I would just think of all that paper. But I usually buy a print newspaper about twice or three times a week. Usually the New York Times, sometimes the Daily News. Never the New York Post. But I was in a hotel on Friday, so I got a free issue of the Wall Street Journal.
This is a great story already. Does it have something to do with Star Trek?
It does. So you can go online, I suppose, to read the article I'm about to talk about. On the Friday, July 8th edition, in what's called the Mansion section of the Wall Street Journal.
That's one of my favorites in the Wall Street Journal.
Shows you how
sure.
ridiculous what the audience is for the Wall. I'm surprised I was allowed to get this even for free at the hotel. So in the Mansion section, which I can't believe that's a daily thing. That's got to be a once in a blue moon thing. But in the Mansion section, on the front, in addition to a beautiful home and a picture of Juliana Margulies, who I love, there is a great story about a millionaire named Mark Bell from Boca Raton, Florida. Not Derek Bell, Mark Bell, Boca Raton, Florida, who built pretty much the bridge of the Enterprise
okay.
D.
Oh, I see. Wow.
As a, look at that
as
picture.
As a screening room.
As a screen, and then also open it up and look in the back page.
This is an actual newspaper here. You can hear it on the microphones. Oh my goodness.
Isn't that gorgeous?
He has a pinball room and an arcade. He has pinball and arcade
it's
machines.
It's all Star Trek stuff. And then that's
his ears. I see. He looks like he has perhaps murdered a Vulcan and collected their ears. I see some tribbles. And he has a beautiful like a memorabilia room with a it looks like a Star Trek themed rug.
Right.
Chairs.
He's a major collector, but this screening room looks fantastic.
It's gorgeous. It is gorgeous.
It really is amazing. And it looks like a nice guy. He's there with his wife. She's a little younger than he is, which doesn't surprise me. But he's extremely wealthy, and he lives in Boca Raton, Florida. I don't know Florida too well, but I'm going to be in Miami in
you
January.
You should have him on the podcast.
Well, why do you think I'm talking about this?
Oh.
No, I don't want to have him on the podcast. Oh. I want to have me at his house. So I'm going to be in Miami in January.
You're inviting yourself over to his house.
No, I would never do anything that gauche. What I'm hoping is that somebody listening knows somebody who knows somebody that works for...
I think the odds are pretty good. If a guy
Mark Bell Capital.
He built the Star Trek Enterprise Bridge in his house. I think there's a decent chance he might be listening to the official Star Trek podcast.
I would like to think so. So Mark Bell of Mark Bell Capital, a very great guy... Look at him. You look in his eyes, and you could see he's a
fine human being.
Oh, you could see he's a great philanthropist and a great
industrialist.
You can say
bicyclist.
He's just a raconteur. You hang out with him, and you just enjoy the company. I don't know how far Boca Raton is from Miami. I'm assuming it's like New Jersey. Everything's close. So what I'm hoping is that when I'm down there in Miami in January,
you want to take a tour.
I would love to go hang out with Mark. So if somebody knows him...
I think that would be very cool for you. My one concern for Mark would be that if he invites you over, it may be like an Ocean's 11 style heist. You might try to pilfer some of this memorabilia that I'm looking at. Those dismembered Vulcaneers. Yeah, I would worry about them. I'd make sure they were locked up before you arrived, because I know you.
It's pretty cool. So no, I don't feel the need to own Star Trek memorabilia, because you know what? That's a Pandora's box. When you open that door, I do have a lot of Star Trek stuff in my home.
I've seen the pictures.
Yeah, very. You've been to my home, haven't you?
No.
You really haven't?
No.
Oh my God. This sounds weird. I these things just kind of fall into my lap, or I get them at conventions very inexpensively. I go to the junk box and I'll buy like the goofy action figures that nobody wants. So I have like Worf in cowboy regalia from Fistful of Worfs, a Fistful of Datas, excuse me. And I'll have like the Dr. McCoy from Encounter at Farpoint. You know, kind of the weird ones that are out of box, just like in a tub. And they cost a buck. But I have a lot of that. Enough that it causes some friction with my wife. But nevertheless, but, you know, so this all leads back to one thing. Star Trek, the original series, ended in 1969. Mm. And then things kind of disappeared. Except for reruns, except for the animated series, which you'd think would be enough. But then in 1979... the new a new day. What was it? The Human Adventure had just begun, and Star Trek the Motion Picture was released in cinemas. And I think most people who follow movies don't really think that Star Trek the Motion Picture is a good film.
No,
people tend to dislike it, and they make fun of it. And
I mean, I used to make fun of it.
Really?
Yeah, when I was younger.
Oh, you called it the Motionless Picture.
I mean, I don't know if I was that witty about it, but I felt that way, sure. I think that you would say that was the conventional wisdom, or right. the widely held belief.
Right. But now you and I are advocates, strong advocates.
Yes.
I love Star Trek the Motion Picture.
I have grown to, I don't know if I would say love, but I've grown to really, really like it and admire it.
Yeah. Let's bring it back a little bit. I want to talk about you and your geek cred, so to speak. And I want to know where you are on the Star Trek spectrum. I know that your geek cred is impeccable. You worked at a comic book. You are a comic book guy. You're the slender version of comic book guy.
Okay.
You know, there's two iterations of comic book guy. Most of them tend to be on the hefty side, as I am.
I was going to say, we fill both of the types in this room.
Most tend to be sort of the chromosomes cut in one way, and what was it called? What's the thing when they... the dominant gene or whatever it is.
There's dominant and recessive.
There you go. The dominant gene of comic book guy is to be a little on the large side, kind of loud, opinionated, oftentimes...
Hoffman-esque.
Olfactory challenged. But then there's the slender comic book guy, which is the recessive comic book guy. And that is you. Embrace yourself. Embrace who you are.
No, yes. I have worked in comic book stores.
How long did you work in a comic book store?
Off and on for like 5 years. I was a manager at one point, assistant manager.
Did you have to fire guys like me?
I never fired anyone, no.
Did you yell at somebody and say, stop?
I definitely had to, you know, not yell, but people slacking off or not doing what I'd asked them, sure.
What about the cliche of the guy working behind the counter who's looking down his nose at a noob or a girl who doesn't know what's going on and yelling? Did you ever have to deal with that kind of employee? Like, stop being a jerk, and if the guy wants to buy Archie, let him buy Archie.
I think I encountered that attitude much more when I worked in a video store years later, and the video store clerks were very snooty about, you know, people being like, do you have any films by Jean-Luc Godard? And they'd be like, you know, it's Godard, get out of my sight, that kind of thing. So the comic book store I worked at, I'm sure we had a little of that, but we were a pretty tolerant, inclusive group.
You know, I gotta say, in terms of maybe because that's such a cliche, all the comic book stores in New York have the greatest
they're pretty good
employees.
We live
Midtown Comics is the nicest. If you're a noob and you go to Midtown Comics, which is a giant, it's a mini chain in New York. There's three of them. The Biggie's in Times Square. And the other Biggie is right near Grand Central. If you go in there and you're like, all my friends are into comics. I don't know. I've seen the X-Men, one of them. What did I do? They have an answer. Like, they'll help you out. They won't be like, well, you have to understand the multiverse and whatnot. They'll help you out.
Well,
so
that should be exciting. You know, this is something you're passionate about. If someone comes in curious, you want to give them something good so that they see what you see in it.
Well, you know,
I always felt anyway.
That's how I feel about Engage, the official Star Trek podcast.
Look at that. What a segue.
So we have people maybe out there that there might be a young person, 14, 15 years old, their first interaction with Star Trek isn't going to be the 2009 movie.
It's going to
be this
Beyond,
movie.
Yeah.
Star Trek Beyond. They'll be like, oh, I heard about Star Trek. I'm going to see Star Trek Beyond, the third film. Chris Pine, handsome fella, Captain Kirk. I know there's this other thing. There's this other movie. Should I watch Star Trek the Motion Picture? And conventional wisdom, as you say, would be like, no, skip straight to Wrath of Khan.
Sure.
And frankly, you could do that.
Yes.
Much like you could watch Star Wars episode 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, and then 6.
Mm.
Or some say 4, 5, skip one entirely, 2, 3, and 6.
Star Wars? You're talking about Star Wars on the Star Trek podcast?
That's totally kosher. I'm surprised that's allowed.
Like the franchise that daren't speak its name.
You're allowed to speak about it, but only X amount of times per month. And then after that, I go over.
Okay,
so
you have a quota.
You have a quota that you can't bring. No. So some people say, skip Star Trek the Motion Picture. You and I say no. And you have a big article that's going up on screencrush.com imminently. By the time this is out in the cybersphere.
Should be out, yeah.
You can read about, which is all your, basically the case you make for Star Trek the Motion Picture.
Yes.
So, I'm gonna read your opening paragraph.
Okay.
It's hilarious. The poster for Star Trek the Motion Picture, which I happen to be wearing a shirt. Bob Peake, I think, is the artist who made this poster.
You are wearing
poster.
The poster as a t-shirt, right? I can see it right now.
Bob, the guy who designed this designed Apocalypse Now. He designed.
It looks like the poster for Apocalypse Now, actually, with the faces in the light.
Yeah, no, it's
very
the same
similar.
Guy, and he's done a host of other extremely important. And he's also a commercial artist in the '60s. He was probably like a guy hanging out with Don Draper in the '60s, designing ads for. I think Marlboro Cigarettes was actually his campaign, which in a way is maybe that's not the best thing to want to talk about, but you can't deny that the art is good. Anywho, so yes, so the story opens, and that's what brought me in. I mentioned this in another podcast that I saw this poster.
Yes,
when
I heard
I was
you talking about
4 years old. I don't want to go over
it,
but I saw this poster when I was 4 years old, and that
it is a gorgeous poster
that dragged me in. It's a gorgeous. This shirt's disgusting though because I've been wearing it for 3 days straight. But the poster for Star Trek: The Motion Picture is so dramatic, says Matt Singer in ScreenCrush.com. The faces of William Shatner's Captain Kirk, Leonard Nimoy's Mr. Spock, and Persis Kambada's Lieutenant Ilia refracted through a rainbow spectrum of light. That image promises excitement beyond imagination. Adventure. Passion. Every color under the rainbow. So why is the film so beige? And then there is a screen cap of Captain Kirk with his arms at his hips.
Yes.
With the weird belt buckle, which if you read the tie-in novel, is called a per-sec, which is like a bio device that could... it's a whole thing. And then everybody else in the bridge is just... There's like beige chairs, beige uniforms. Everything is... Spock is kind of creamy blue. It's not a very colorful movie.
No.
Nevertheless, I think the look of this film is what draws me back to it again and again, even though it doesn't really look like what we think about for Star Trek. Do you have a bone of contention with that? Or?
No, I mean, I think that is exactly right. I mean, I think there are ways we can defend those somewhat dated or very dated costumes. I think there are reasons why they kind of work for the material, even though it does kind of look like, Star Trek: The Wrath of Khaki. but the visuals in general, I think, are one of the most beautiful things about the movie and one of the best things about the movie. I mean, I certainly wouldn't make the case that Star Trek the Motion Picture is the best Star Trek movie. There are a couple that I would definitely put ahead of it. But it might be the most movie-ish movie, at least until the more recent ones, at least until maybe like the J.J. Abrams Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like a movie. And even some of the better movies, they feel smaller. Like I was just rewatching Wrath of Khan, which is, fabulous, incredible, magnificent. Yeah. But it feels like a smaller movie, which it was. Like, it doesn't have that grandeur, that widescreen scope.
With the exception of the Mutara Nebula, I would say. That sequence is pretty great, but that's all special effects.
Right.
Much of the Wrath of Khan is Kirk and Khan talking to each other on sets, talking to a wall.
Right.
It's great, but you're right. It doesn't have the visual scope of something like motion picture. It certainly doesn't have the bright colors of the original series, but that was very much by design. Robert Wise, the director, who we'll talk about in a moment, when he got the job, as with so many Star Trek directors, had
never seen Star Trek.
Nicholas Meyer, J.J. Abrams, Robert Wise, they never really watched Star Trek until they got a check, and then they suddenly became Star Trek fans. But He was looking at, and he said that those colors are too much. It's
right.
Not going to
work.
Supposedly
he screened the whole show in a screening room at the Paramount lot on a big screen and looked at it on the big screen and said, those red, yellow, and blue costumes ain't going to work.
And who knows?
Too garish.
Too much. And he might be right. Who knows? But
well, they never really used them until the more recent movies. So he might have had a point.
He might have had a point. And also in the more recent ones, the costumes have the color pop. But as people joked, the bridge looks like the Apple Store. It's all white,
right,
and sort of cool blue.
Yes,
like a kind of a sort of a
LED blue.
Is that really what it's called? LED blue.
That's what I just called it.
I was going to call like a Caribbean Sea, resort spring water blue.
Right.
But I like LED blue also.
I mean, I think it's very easy to laugh at the costumes in the motion picture. In fact, I still do occasionally. When you see Bones has a V-neck that is literally V'd down below his nipples.
Right.
His chest hair is like fully exposed.
So good. It's so good. But I'll tell you something, though. And here's a point. Original series is 60s Star Trek.
Right.
The movies, Wrath of Khan, Search for Spock, Voyage Home, the classic movies, are 80s Star Trek.
Yes, I see where you're going with this.
Next Generation is 90s Star Trek. The only visual representation of 70s Star Trek,
right,
and I don't, unless you count the animated series, which I'm not going to go that far, is this. This is a very 70s movies, a very 70s movie in its themes.
Yes.
And also in its look, it really is. The other thing about the costumes is, it's the only time you'll see Spock again from certain angles. Spock's uniform when he comes back from Vulcan,
yes,
after he's said, "I will not do the Kolinar rituals," and he's got that crazy looking hair and whatnot. When he comes back, he's in a gown, he's in a cloak, which is amazing, and then he goes and gets his uniform back on.
Right,
it's different from his show uniform. But from certain angles, it looks very, very similar. And from certain angles, his hair looks exactly the same. And although he is older, he's 10 years older, from certain angles, he looks a lot like the show. But it's shot with better lenses, better film stock, better lighting, and
a wider frame.
A wider
too.
Frame. So there are moments where if you just kind of blink at it, it looks like the show, but
the show never ended, essentially?
A little bit, because his uniform is it's not the exact same shade of blue.
Sure.
But it's similar.
It's more pastel.
And he's got the bands around his wrist. There's a term for this.
You don't know it?
It's not the pips, because the pips are on, it's the band that tells you what his rank is.
You're
going to
get so many emails about this, aren't you?
I know. I've always said that I'm the fan who can never remember the name of things. That's what makes me me. But nevertheless, there are certain angles where it really does look like the show, and that's amazing, because it's the only, and doesn't work the same for Bones or Scotty or Kirk, but for him, it's pretty great.
Well, I think there's something fitting about these 70s costumes. I don't think we want to spend too much more time on it, but the costumes from the old show are gorgeous, right? But maybe there is something slightly impractical about wandering alien planets in brightly colored yellow velour. Like, that might not be the best fashion choice for an away team.
Those are advanced space age polymers that will protect you from microbes and
I just think that when I look at Star Trek the Motion Picture, while yes, some of those V-necks or some of the belt buckles without a belt, I know they serve a purpose supposedly in the story, but the fact that they're wearing belt buckles with no belts just always looks so kind of silly to me. But just the idea that they don't really seem to care too much about the colors and this and that, it's like, that doesn't seem like something Starfleet should be worried too much about.
Right, no, they're very pragmatic and they're pragmatic. They're worried about the betterment of society and of all these sort of intellectual pursuits, which is very Gene Roddenberry, and there's a lot of Gene Roddenberry in this story. It's sort of it's absolutely the most Gene Roddenberry of the movies, and there is, and we can get into a little bit about the behind the scenes of how the movie was created. There are a lot of similarities between the motion picture and the somewhat beleaguered first season and a half of The Next Generation, because they both have their roots in Star Trek Phase 2, which was the Star Trek show that never happened, that has Roddenberry's fingerprints on him a lot, that a lot of people don't like. You know, some people can't handle the full rod, is what it is. When you get the full rod, you get
a lot.
Yeah.
It is a lot.
Roddenberry is like...
But again, that's part of what I like about this movie.
Roddenberry's like cooking with rosemary. Like, a little bit goes a long way, and you're going to taste it in every bite.
Right.
And if you don't like rosemary, you're not going to like the soup. And if you don't like Roddenberry...
This is like eating a handful of rosemary.
It really is.
If you
don't like... Roddenberry, he's a little bit corny. He's so pure.
Very sincere.
Which is funny, because if you learn about the guy was a human being. He was not a saint, but he... Probably because his personal life was a little bit of a disaster area, he was able to project this perfection into his art. And when you get the full rod, you get a very dorky Star Trek.
Right.
I do gravitate toward his stuff, you know, and there's something wonderful. You know, I think the most Roddenberry character in all of Star Trek is probably Wesley Crusher.
Hmm.
You know?
That's interesting.
Some people can't handle... Well, right. His middle name is Wesley Roddenberry. Mm-hmm. And some people hate Wesley Crusher in that rainbow sweater.
Right.
I cannot tell a lie. You know, I was the right age for Next Generation when it started.
You projected a lot onto Wesley Crusher is what you're saying.
It never dawned on me that Wesley wasn't cool. Until years later.
That says so much about you.
I was stunned. I was stunned to learn, because I thought he was great. And
this guy is so cool. Oh my God.
It never dawned on me.
He's the coolest.
He saved the day. You know, he was the
most. That's fair.
He was the Mozart of the galaxy in terms of isolinear chips and various other things.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Welcome back to Engage.
Engage.
The official Star Trek podcast with your host, Jordan Hoffman.
You are, after all, irrational.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about our friend Robert Wise, who was... the movie was already on its way. The production story, and this has been documented in a million different places, 1975, Roddenberry's called into Paramount. They're thinking about bringing Star Trek back as a motion picture. They pitch one movie called...
The God Thing?
Well, there's The God Thing. Is it The God Thing?
The God Thing sounds kind of like The Full Rod, to be honest with you.
The God Thing... Yes. No, what's the other one called?
Planet of the Titans.
Planet of the Titans. Thank you. Planet of the Titans. Which the guys who wrote Don't Look Now, the Nicholas Roeg film with the dwarf with the hatchet and Julie Christie and...
Donald Sutherland.
Thank you. They wrote Planet of the Titans, which was a kind of a spin on Who Mourns for Adonais, and also The Chase, the later episode, which was that the seeds of mankind came from ourselves.
From Captain Kirk.
All right, so Captain Kirk.
Captain Kirk
fire
goes back in time and gives fire to cavemen.
Right.
It sounds amazing. Yes. It would have been directed by Philip Kaufman, who
right.
later did the Invasion of the Body Snatchers with Leonard Nimoy.
With Leonard Nimoy, so he got his Nimoy fix
if
in there.
Let me tell you something. If you think Star Trek the Motion Picture is alienating and cold and distant and weird and right. inaccessible, Planet of the Titans would have made that look like the voyage home.
It would have been crazy.
It would have been amazing.
Then there was a project called The God Thing, which is not that dissimilar from the motion picture.
Yeah.
And there are some similarities with Star Trek V, although Roddenberry never liked that. The basic premise is a being is coming toward Earth, causing destruction along the way.
Claims to be God. The Enterprise has to stop it.
And then it turns out, I may get this wrong, it's not really God. But
Spoiler alert for a movie that was never made.
Yes, it is a super being from a parallel dimension.
Hate when that happens.
That had somehow incepted the concepts of God on that exist in our timeline, come from it and vice versa, or something like that.
And supposedly that draft of this film or whatever was then transmuted into the pilot of Phase 2, which never happened,
which was
transmuted yet again into the script for the motion picture.
But what's funny about this, and it brings us back to today, another key thing happened. Star Wars happened.
Right.
And every bean counter
in
Hollywood.
And Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Right. Yes. And they said, holy
crap.
Sci-fi
is back.
Sci-fi is big.
It's big business.
These guys with cigars in restaurants going, where's our space bucks?
Right.
And they said, why don't we get our space bucks from Star Trek, which we have the rights to anyhow. They're sitting around. And they decided to make this movie. But Roddenberry, who had been working all this time, he wrote a film, one of Quentin Tarantino's favorite films, Pretty Maids All in a Row.
Oh, that is a weird movie.
And he did some TV pilots, the Questor tapes, which is similar. Roddenberry loved to, if he liked an idea, he used it again and again. The Questor tapes is not that dissimilar from motion picture in that it's about a mechanical being searching for its creator.
Right.
And then he did Genesis 2, which was sort of like a person from, it's kind of like Idiocracy but serious,
gets sent into the future, wakes up in the future.
And then Genesis 2 was going to be a series. They did the pilot, he had commissioned other scripts, some of those scripts were then reused for Phase 2 later down the line. Genesis 2 was done again, he was trying to do it as another series, he called it Planet Earth. So he was a busy guy, it wasn't like he was just playing racquetball the whole time. But then Phase 2 was going on. The point I'm making is that while they started production, Paramount said that they were going to make what would then have been a fourth network. ABC, NBC, CBS, and now Paramount. And they were going to lead with this new Star Trek.
Right.
Which is funny because...
It's not all that dissimilar from...
Well, not dissimilar from Voyager when UPN led with Voyager and where we are right now.
Where we are right now, yeah.
I mean, a fourth network in 1979 was lunacy. There wasn't a fourth network till Fox in 1990, blah, 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 whenever that was.
Or late 80s, but sure.
I didn't really notice it until the 90s, but okay.
Oh, I was too busy with Star Trek to notice such things.
It was insanity, and now you have a major network, CBS, which we have to speak nicely about because we're in their building, that is going to start a new streaming platform, and they're leading with Star Trek, which is great, but it's funny because history repeats itself. You want to launch something new, why not launch it with the most costly, unwieldy property that usually brings makes great entertainment, but brings destruction to the financial entities that back it. Desilu Studios nearly losing their shirt over Star Trek back in the 60s. We're doing it again with Star Trek 2017, whatever that title will be. Anyway, the movie was on its way. Robert Wise, the director. People may not realize just how important of a figure in film history Robert Wise is. Matt Singer, as the editor-in-chief of Screen Crush, movie maven that you are. Has anyone called you a movie maven before?
Not without meaning it insultingly.
Tell us a little bit about Robert Wise.
Well, he was a director for decades by the time. I mean, Star Trek the Motion Picture was towards the end of his filmmaking career. He famously worked with Orson Welles. He was the editor of Citizen Kane. He worked on Magnificent Ambersons and, supposedly was involved in the, you know, the cut, the theatrical cut of that, where the butchery of that film, right, depending on who you listen to.
I think he did the right thing. I think Orson Welles needed to be kept in check. That's what I say. Orson Welles, who, by the way, did the voiceover for the Star Trek
motion picture.
I never thought about that.
William Shatner is Captain Kirk.
Oh, I love that theatrical. That there's two trailers for Star Trek the motion picture, both of which are brilliant, but the teaser is so spooky. It's so 70s. It's got that silent running Saturn III vibe. It's this spooky stuff. And it's Orson Welles. And he actually says, a Robert Wise film. And that's his old employee.
Yep.
He was, on a good day, he's probably very proud of his associate, Robert. If he was drunk on Paul Masson wine and in one of his angry moods, he was probably so bitter and so angry that he had to do that.
He might have been.
Because he hated doing voiceover to the end of his career.
But yeah, I mean, Robert Wise was like a great studio director, and he worked in every kind of genre. He made sci-fi movies. He made horror movies.
Well, I wanna
musicals.
Horror, The Haunting.
The Haunting, which is a masterpiece.
Really is one of the greatest horror films ever made. So scary, and you don't see anything. It's
very
all in your
spooky.
Head. Musicals. My Fair Lady. Sound of Music, and 50% of West Side Story.
50% of West Side
Story. Co-directed
West Side
Story. These are the three biggest musicals you can think of. Sci-fi, two movies. One of the most important sci-fi American sci-fi movies of the 1950s, The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Right.
The guy directed Gort and Spock. Holy cow. I'm assuming the most people have seen The Day the Earth Stood Still. And one that is another extremely 70s movie, which you and I were talking about before, called The Andromeda Strain. The Andromeda Strain, based on a Michael Crichton novel, might be his first novel. I think it was. Huge success. And the look of Star Trek the motion picture, if you love that look, close-ups of graphics, cool lighting, lots of filtered light, color saturation, hallways, white hallways, blue hallways.
What's more exciting than hallways?
From a visual point of view, I'm saying that Star Trek the motion picture has a look, and that look, you can find its roots in The Andromeda Strain.
All right.
Also worked with Douglas Trumbull, the special effects advisor who worked on motion picture, worked on The Andromeda Strain. Also, it's basically the same movie, because people who complain about Star Trek the motionless picture will say, you want to know what Star Trek the motion picture is about? It's about the thing in space and a bunch of guys getting a ship and go look at it. And that's kind of it. It's 2 hours and 20 minutes of people going to a place. It takes a really long time. The Andromeda Strain is going to go one better. It's about a bunch of guys who take an elevator down for 2 hours. It takes an hour. It takes a half of this movie for a guy to get to a spot off in the distance, Project Wildfire, it's called, and he's got to descend 6 levels. He's washing, he's scrubbing, he's putting on booties. There's a room where he's zapped with yellow rays, with red rays, but it looks fantastic. Some people don't like The Andromeda Strain. I think it's absolutely fantastic. And then at the end, there's a bad thing that's happening. It's a space virus. I'm going to spoil the movie, but it's from 1971. It's kind of the same as the motion picture. Like, the motion picture is, there's a thing, it's going to destroy the Earth. They get to it, and it kind of works out pretty, like, they don't have to fight it or anything. They do a couple of things, and they fix it. Andromeda Strain, mankind is about to be killed, like, in 10 minutes. Get your act together, unless these scientists can figure it out. And then they kind of figure it out, and then it's it. And it's not like a big aha moment. Michael Crichton, never too good with endings, I will say.
Well, this has been a great episode of the Andromeda Strain podcast, Jordan. Thanks for having me on.
It's a great movie. I'm saying people should check it out.
When you're describing it, I mean, here's how we can relate it back to Star Trek the motion picture. What you're describing in that film and Robert Wise's approach to it is this fascination with detail and with process. And I think that's what you also see in Star Trek the motion picture, and one of the things I like about it. You know, yes, it is not the most exciting Star Trek movie. In many ways, it might be the least exciting Star Trek movie. But what I love about Star Trek is that it can contain multitudes. It can, you know, you can make an adventure story within Star Trek. You can also make a very detailed granular story about what it might be like to be on this ship in outer space going to encounter this strange alien presence that no one has ever seen before. And the incredibly detailed way that you have to leave space dock, right? Yeah. Everyone makes fun of the space dock sequence in this movie because it's like 45 minutes before the ship even leaves. You know, the old Star Trek TV show, the ship is moving at light speed before the credits are over. In this movie, it takes 45 minutes just for the ship to leave the dock.
I believe the first bit of what you might call action is the wormhole sequence.
Right, which slows the movie down. They go into warp speed, they go in a wormhole, and everyone is moving at slow motion and talking like they're imitating Dory doing whale voice.
Photon torpedoes. That is the greatest scene.
My favorite one is,
belay that order. I think it's actually, belay that phaser order.
It's even longer. I mean, this is a movie where the action scenes slow the movie down, and it was a slow movie to begin with.
But that's what makes us brilliant.
Yes, that is what I... But I don't know about brilliant, but that is what I like about it, because it is more interested in these other things. And what's great about Star Trek now is you can go, and whatever mood you're in, there is a Trek film for that.
Right.
If you are in the mood to watch a film about how they leave space dock and how you go up to the ship in a little shuttlecraft,
yeah,
and how different things work on the ship, this is a good one to do that.
And it's something that was never really replicated in any other visual Star Trek. I mean, there are a zillion books out there, and some of them are very detail-oriented, and you can really dig into the engineering aspects or just sort of sink your teeth into one sequence, but this is it. This is a one-time deal, and I think that's part of that was the 70s, man. People made weird movies back then.
Yeah.
And they rolled the dice on a big budget, and like you say, it was the only time that the procedural aspects of it. I mean, you know, it's funny to think about the 70s had a series of movies that are often joked about called the Airport series.
Mm-hmm.
Airport 77, you know, with a Concorde jet under the sea with Jack Lemmon or something like mm-hmm. that. The first Airport movie, which was nominated for Academy Awards, by the way, is not really an action movie.
No, it's a movie about an airport. And in classic Hollywood fashion, it was very popular, and yeah, so they made dumb sequels out of it.
Right,
they took a
right.
relatively serious movie. I mean, it has like, you know, explosions and
at
things
the
like
end,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is mostly about the running of an airport on a particularly exciting day.
Right.
But it's still about bureaucracy
right.
and middle management. It
right.
is kind of like Star Trek: The Motion
Picture.
It kind of
is, but not beautiful.
No.
It's kind of an ugly movie.
But then the sequels all were about, they were disaster films.
They
really were the original disaster films.
Right, right. And I think that this was a time when, for whatever reason, just like focusing on what, you know, the first half hour of Star Trek Motion Picture, really nothing happens. They're going up to a thing, and then what would it be like? You're getting the band back together, you meet every member of the crew, and, you know, I could understand people not being into that, but I think that a certain type of person is going to really...
I completely understand it, and like I said, I used to, you know, make fun of it, think it was slow and boring, and I absolutely can understand anyone feeling that way.
Yeah.
But as I get older, there is something about this movie that resonates. You know, they talk about the you know, with every movie, as the actors got older, they became more and more about sort of mortality and aging.
Yeah.
And this was the first movie, and this was the first one where they really deal with that. I mean, the fact that Kirk, the great captain of all time, is bound to his desk
yeah.
and so desperate to get back in the sky, get back in space, that he kicks the new captain of the Enterprise, basically, like, just shows up and is like, hey, guys, I'm in charge now. Not only are you not the captain, I'm demoting you to commander.
He had to do it. It was desperate times.
Of course. And he uses, and they talk about it in the movie. But just the idea that these guys, you know, they were getting older. And yes, they made some great action movies with this cast later on.
Yeah.
But I think there's something to the idea that we were cowboys in the 60s. Now we're middle-aged.
Right.
You know, we're getting older. We're not really running at top speed anymore.
Right,
I think there's
right.
something true about that.
What do you think about the changes to the characters? Because there's not a lot of humor in this movie. There's a lot of humor in all of original series and in the other films.
Yeah.
This one, there's one or two moments of levity when Kirk begs Spock to take a seat. He's like, damn it, will you sit down?
Right.
And there's like one or two other little moments like that. But it's very straight, very earnest. And Kirk is a little, like, if this is the first thing you've ever, if you've never watched Star Trek, and then you watch Star Trek The Motion Picture, that's the first thing you ever see, you're going to be like, boy, this guy Captain Kirk, kind of a jerk.
Yep.
Kind of joyless.
Yep.
Spock, not, like, why do people like this guy? He's real.
So remote. So emotionless.
Yeah, more so than in any other episode. I mean, the whole shtick of Spock earlier was that he's got the war within him between his Vulcan side, his human side. And in this film, there definitely is an arc of, at the end, after he mind melds with V'ger, he's practically like in a sort of a euphoric state. He's not really smiling, but he has this gleam in his eye. He looks dazed. And he ultimately, after Star Trek The Motion Picture, knows that he's got to embrace his human side. He's lucky to have that. But in most of the movie, like, there's a bit that I think in the series would have gone a lot better, which is when Bones is sort of needling Spock a little bit, and there should have been a reaction shot. Well, I'm not going to say should have. There could have been a reaction shot of Spock kind of raising his eyebrow or kind of sighing a little bit.
Deflating the tension.
Deflating the tension. And in this version, it's just boom, complete stone face.
Right.
And not for a laugh.
Here's why I like all this stuff you're saying.
Yeah.
Because this movie is set 10 years after the TV show. We're getting a ton of these movies nowadays. You know, I call them lega sequels because we take this popular thing that we loved from 10, 20 years ago. We bring it back. We restore it. We put in some new characters, but we bring back all the old cast to sort of anoint them, to give them our approval, and to send them off. I mean, in a way, the Abrams Star Trek was that, in the way that had Leonard Nimoy on hand to pass off the franchise.
Sort of a weird
generation.
Example, but you're talking about movies like Independence Day Resurgence.
Independence Day Resurgence. Star Wars The Force Awakens. Right. I hope I'm not affecting your quota. Star Wars mentions. There's a bunch of them. It's a Jurassic World. Yep. It's a very popular thing now. And a lot of times, the characters that do return, they are older, but they try so hard to recapture what we love about the old characters.
Right. Yeah.
And what I like about this is, even though we haven't seen that time, it really feels like these characters have grown and evolved since we last saw them, right?
Yeah.
Like, Captain Kirk is a different guy. He's not the guy from the TV show.
Yeah.
And in a way, it's kind of sad because he desperately wants to be that guy.
Yeah.
And that's what getting old is. Being older is like looking back at your life and saying, I miss the guy I was when I was 25. And hopefully, if you like this movie, at the end, you kind of go, well, no, but it's okay to be this age. You embrace it, right? And I think that's what Spock's arc is so interesting about. And why I love that is that that character actually evolves. And I think one of the problems with it is that, spoiler alert for a movie that I guarantee everyone listening has heard, like, he dies in the next movie. And I feel like, and then he resets in a way.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
The evolution of the character is stunted by the next movie, which is great, which I love. But right, I feel like the stuff that this movie did to the character is wiped away so quickly that it doesn't even register.
That's a good point. Like, you know, at the end of Motion Picture,
you would know this better than I do. Is this the first time he calls Kirk Jim?
No, absolutely
not. It's
not.
Okay.
No.
Because when he says it in this movie, there's like a tenderness to it that is surprising to me.
It's the first time that, with the exception of the end of A Mock Time, when he calls him Jim then, when he's thrilled that he didn't kill him.
Okay.
Maybe because he didn't want to go to jail. But, you know, but he's thrilled that he didn't kill him. And he's just beaming and he's smiling and he's practically embraces him. And then he goes, oh, excuse me.
Right.
But it's one of the few times where he talks about their friendship. You know, you're talking about the scene where he's in the bio bed.
Yes.
Yeah. I think it's the only time where he definitely talks about their friendship before, but in a sort of a very clinical, Aspergian way, he's like, our friendship is important. You know,
right.
Human connection is good for the crew,
right,
and for the working of the ship. It's the first time he's like, you know, I need to be your friend for me, you know, that you know, it's not for any logical purpose other than our love.
This simple feeling.
Yeah.
It's a very powerful scene, actually.
It's heavy stuff. Certainly very 70s. It's very, you know, hang out in an est group and bang a drum and you know, that sort of thing. It's pretty great.
He really does have this transformation in the movie. I mean, you see, because he's become so logical, so Vulcan with the Kulinar and all that,
yeah,
and that he through this.
So logical, he doesn't even get a haircut.
through that encounter with V'ger,
yes,
he sort of has this evolution. And I really wonder if he had not died in Wrath of Khan, what, like, sort of how the character would have continued to evolve after that.
Would he have become, would he have become so, I don't want to say anti-Vulcan, but would he have embraced emotion so much that he would have been more like Cybok?
That's an interesting, I mean, it's an interesting thought experiment, but it's, yeah, again, it's one of the things where I feel like it's something that's held against the movie that's not the movie's fault. Like, I feel like the stuff with Spock in this movie is good, and if it wasn't for it being immediately undone by the next movie. People might feel differently about it.
Shatner's performance is so great in this because he's ready to kick ass from the first frame. He exits a shuttle.
He's so angry,
and there's this, I gotta say, very sexy woman behind him who's giving him eyes. You gotta watch that scene again. There's a woman, she's got like short hair, and she's looking him up and down, and we don't, like, what were they schmoozing beforehand? We don't know. She doesn't have a name. She's a very alluring woman in the shuttle with him. And he's, like you say, total jerk to Decker. Well, no, he's not a jerk. He's just very...
He's business. There's no warmth.
He's all business.
In a way, it's in a way he mirrors Spock. He's gotten colder over the years too,
and he's wrong, and he admits that he's wrong in a great moment, maybe one of my favorite moments of the film, when he screws up a few times. In fact, you know, Decker has to belay that phaser order,
right?
And there's something else that he does that's wrong, and Decker
saves the day.
Decker saves the day, and he gives some commentary on something, and Kirk gives him a look, and Decker's like, as executive officer, it is my job to point out options. Basically, it's his job to be the ombudsman, to kind of just shove ideas in the face. And Kirk looks like he's going to kick his ass, and he takes a deep breath, and then he points his finger at him. He goes, I forget the exact wording, but he's like, "You're absolutely right." And I just can't tell. You can watch it three times in a row. I just can't tell if Kirk is admitting he's wrong or he's like giving him the kill him with kindness respect. It's such a nuanced performance that I don't know.
Or Shatner forgot his line for a second and took a longer pause than he meant to?
I trust the Shat. He's better than that. It's such a fine line. And if I was Decker... And I would go, if I'm going back to my quarter that day and I'm hanging out and your wife says, how was your day at work? I'd be like, you know, the captain said this thing to me and I don't know if he meant it nice or if he meant it mean, and it would keep you up all night.
But that is, to me, that's what life on a starship would be, right? Like, you know, it's your job.
Right.
Everyone in Star Trek, and it's one of the things we love about it, they're like a family, and everyone so often gets along. There's strife at times, but it's all about the family. And here you see, like what it would be like to hate your boss on the starship, and it's your job and you're stuck there and there's nothing you can do. Like, that is a relatable thing within this movie.
You know, it's funny because everybody, you know, Next Generation, everybody loved Picard. He was the great, and I think Picard is the great, not only the greatest captain, he's of Star Trek. He's the greatest leader in all in the entire galaxy. You know? I would follow Picard anywhere. And there's that great episode, and of course I can't remember the exact name. I think it's from season 4 or so, when Picard is kidnapped and replaced by a proxy, a facsimile, and people can tell that it's not Picard because he's being too nice. And they go to 10 forward, and it's a great moment. He's like, a toast. Here's to the greatest crew in all of Starfleet. And the rank and file, like, yeah, we're drinking with the captain. All right. But Riker and Troy and Geordi are like, what the hell's going on? This is not the captain. You know, something's up. And it's like, to be the captain, you got to be a little tough, you know, which is why I'm a terrible boss. You know, I could never be the editor in chief of Screen Crush because
You're not the jerk that I am. Can I compliment one other little detail of practicality that I love in this movie totally had forgotten until I rewatched it this time? You know, everyone, it's like a cliche now when the ships in Star Trek, when they get hit by lasers or whatever, everyone, you know, leans and falls and everything. And in this movie, they gave Kirk a harness.
Seatbelt,
basically. Yep. The wings, and it's a cool design, the wings of his chair, the captain's chair, fold down so that when things happen, everyone's kind of jostling around and the captain is not going anywhere. And I was like, first of all, that was a great idea. what took them so long to think of it? And why did it go away? Because if they didn't, that didn't linger.
Inertial dampeners took care of it in the future. I don't know why it went away. That's
but it's symptomatic of the ideas in this movie, which are like practicality and how things would work on this ship.
Yeah, there are a lot of really cool things you see in this movie, other than just like doohickeys in the background and cool lighting effects and whatnot. There's the rec room.
They have wrist communicators that kind of look like my my step counter that I wear on my wrist.
Yes, the wrist communicator is cool, but then they upgraded to, you know,
to the I know, those were cool.
The comm badge.
I feel like we have to, I know we're probably running out of time soon, but I feel like we have to at least address like the main criticism which people have about the movie, which is that not only is it slow, but these long sequences where quote-unquote nothing happens, right? Where, like, Kirk going up to the ship, and also right. the sequence of entering V'ger.
Like, twice. Which
right, it enters it, and then it re-enters it.
And then Spock enters alone.
Right. I mean, I have my own thoughts, but I'm curious, like, how would you defend those sequences?
I'm too close to Star Trek to... I wish it was longer, but I recognize that I have a problem. I love it. Yes, it's long, but it's beautiful.
It's beautiful.
It's Douglas Trumbull, the same guy who did 2001. The mm-hmm. the sequences of entering V'ger are using many of the same techniques that were used in 2001.
Yeah.
And the shots of Spock floating and then doing that mind meld, I love it. I think it's great. I think the whole excuse me. I think the visual look of everything. Sorry, coughing in your ear there. I do know you made fun in your article about the security guys looking like they had just been playing laser tag.
Yeah, those costumes are not the most, I would say, professional looking.
No, but they do look like Spaceballs. They really do.
They do look like Spaceballs. You're right. I might have to add a reference there. I might have to steal your line and add a little Spaceballs reference there.
That's fine. I mean, it is long, but it's beautiful. It's widescreen, and it's a thing that could only have happened once. I mean... Yes, a Paramount executive might have been in their right to, you know, when they saw a cut of the movie, say, cut that out, cut that out, cut that out, and you'll have a more likable movie.
Right.
Critics were not kind to Star Trek the Motion Picture, but it did really well. In fact, if you take an account of inflation...
It's like the most successful one, right?
Well, no, it's the third.
Okay.
Behind... 2009 and Star Trek Into Darkness.
So it's the most successful of the original of the Shatner Nimoy movies.
It's the most successful of Shatner Nimoy and most successful of certainly of any of the Picard era.
Right.
So that is a bit of a misconception that people say that it was a flop. It was not a flop at the box office, but you know, people. But
it was critical flop for the most
critical,
part. For sure.
I think, frankly, people probably went and were disappointed. You know, it's possible. I don't know. I would have to ask people at the time.
I think some of the feelings about it now, in the slowness and the that you know that nothing happens, et cetera, is partly the way it's been watched for the last 25 plus years, which is on a television, God forbid, on a phone or a tablet or something.
Right, right.
This is not a movie really to be watched on a computer or a little screen. This is a movie that you need to be enveloped by.
Yeah.
That you need to get lost in. Like, I think one of the reasons that Star Trek has endured as well as it has is the other movies play very well on television. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So Wrath of Khan is a great movie to watch on TV. And like those movies play over and over on cable, and they're wonderful. I've probably seen Star Trek 3 more than any others because it was on TV the most when I was a kid, and it was a great movie to just watch over and over again.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. Well,
and this movie, you can't be looking at your phone, you can't be looking at your email, you can't be playing a Pokemon Go.
No.
You have to give yourself over to it. It belongs to a different era.
It belongs to a different era, and also that is an anomaly for Star Trek. I mean, Star Trek, and I've said this before, and I'll say again, Star Trek is a television show more than anything else. The movies are sort of an on the side, an additional thing. The current ones certainly do have a lot of visual splendor, and the other ones are great in a group environment. I mean, watch Star Trek IV: The Voyage Home with a group, and
it's
the laughs are there and it's terrific. But yeah, this is one that really does have that big sweep. And let's not forget the score.
Oh, the score. How can we go so long about this movie and not mention the score?
I don't, because we're fools.
We're dopes.
We're dopes. And the sound effects. those twangs of the photon torpedo. But the score, Jerry Goldsmith's score, which so greatly incorporated the original in little moments that I kind of forgot about it sometimes. And I watched it again recently. I'm like, oh, yeah, there is that little moment of the original series score in there. But the Star Trek The Motion Picture score, of course, became the Next Generation score.
Right.
If you probably were to poll people, if you were to go in the street and say to somebody, sing me the theme to Star Trek, what would they sing?
They might. Well, I mean, the original theme from the TV show is very memorable, and I could sing it for you if you wanted me to.
I'm not asking you. I said a man in the street.
But I think you're right. I think, to me, if you go even further and say, like, what's the best music the franchise ever produced, this has to be up there on the list. If it's not in the top one, it's in the top three for sure.
Oh, for certain, yeah.
And it has this amazing majesty to it and optimism. Like, there's something very Star Trek to me about the music. It feels like this sort of hopeful adventure summed up in a musical theme.
And not just that, the notorious, and we've touched on it a few times, the space dock sequence. There's no dialogue.
Right. It's a showcase.
It's a showcase, and it's an uninterrupted piece of music for X amount of minutes, which you'd never see in a movie ever.
Right.
Really, even in big Hollywood roadshow era, in the era of Lawrence of Arabia, you would have an overture and an entr'acte, as it was called, but you wouldn't have 6 minutes or whatever of just pure music to visuals.
Right.
I mean, other than like a movie like Disney's Fantasia or something like that, and that wasn't original score.
Right. I mean,
that was stinkers like Tchaikovsky, not Jerry Goldsmith.
Chris Pine had an interesting comment recently. Someone asked him about more cerebral Star Trek in movies, and I thought he said that basically he doesn't think that it would work anymore. And I thought he might be right. And I think that but I also think that that's kind of okay. Like, I'm not trying to judge the new movies. I enjoy the new movies a lot.
Yeah.
But I think there is something special about the fact that there was a time when we got a cerebral Star Trek movie that was huge and epic and expensive and weird and strange and off-putting.
Yeah, Pine is probably right, and that's a shame. I mean, there are art films out there, but they're done on a very small budget, or they're anomalies. Or they have Brad Pitt producing them, like Tree of Life.
But this is not just about Star Trek. I mean, he's talking about Hollywood in general.
No, he's absolutely right. Yeah,
he's talking about blockbusters, and that's what these new Trek movies are. And I think for what they do, at least the first one, I wasn't a huge fan of the last one, and I'm excited about the new one. The first one was a very good example of that sort of movie making. But I just think that it's great. Again, I think I've said this already. It's just like, I like that Star Trek is so malleable, and that it can it contains multitudes, the infinite diversity, the infinite combinations. Yes. Right, you get there literally is a Star Trek movie for whatever mood you're in, and sometimes I feel like feeling bummed out about the fact that I'm getting old and pondering the nature of intelligence and emotion in the universe.
And you want to watch, you pop in your Blu-ray of the motion picture, dim the lights, crank up the speakers. Well, you know, talk about the malleability. That's what this new show is, I think, is going to be. In the Brian Fuller's new show, not that I know, but I have a hunch, is not going to be season 8 of Next Generation.
Right.
It's going to be an adaptation of the Star Trek world to the new style of television series in the vein of a Breaking Bad, Mad Men, Homeland, 13 episodes, one arc. It's not going to be 30 episodes where you say, "Oh, like this week's a Troy episode, this week's a Worf episode." It's going to be very different. So a bit of a shock to the system, the Star Trek fans, but it really shouldn't be,
right?
Because as you're saying, Star Trek has always been different.
It's
iterations.
That's part of what makes it fantastic. And this the motion picture, you know, the other thing we've kind of touched on it too. It's like the characters are older. It's a movie for adults. You know, like that's why I say, like, when I was a kid, I didn't really like it. You know, the new Star Trek movies, they're for a younger audience. They have a younger new young cast. The Star Trek, the first film series, was a bunch of middle-aged to almost senior-aged stars. And that's something else that kind of made all of those movies anomalous of great, is that they were, and especially the first movie, they were movies for adults, great.
It was rated G, but also...
But that was the way that ratings worked back then.
It was rated G, but could scare the hell out of you. There are some scary sequences. The death in the transporter room is terrifying.
Very, very troubling, actually.
The sounds they make are just awful. I think that's the scariest moment in all of Star Trek. the wormhole sequence that we've been mocking can spook you as a kid. That slow down. And by the way, those the streaming, that was all hand painted. That was animated. That was not a computer generated effect.
It's just the fact that they're moving in slow
motion.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a parody of the movie within the movie.
Right, but it's still spooky. And then even just some of the images of the three times entering the V'ger cloud, it's spooky stuff, you know, for a little kid, you know?
Right, well, there's an amazing shot. There's not a lot of shots of the actual Enterprise inside V'ger. I think that might have had to do with how long it took to make the effects. They were very behind schedule. But there's one shot where...
tiny little Enterprise, right?
The Enterprise is like a speck in this giant cloud, and you've spent 35 minutes establishing how big the Enterprise is when Kirk and Scotty go up in their tiny little, space shuttle up to it.
Yeah.
So... the fact that now that giant ship is dwarfed by this, it really kind of conveys the scope of this danger.
All right, so we're going to close with this thought experiment. Let's pretend that Star Trek didn't exist except for 1979, Star Trek the Motion Picture shows up. Which you would have to tweak the story a little bit because the return of Spock on the bridge wouldn't mean much.
Right.
But with a couple of tweaks in this parallel universe, you could make... this movie.
This is like someone's gone back in time and destroyed a ship and it skewed us into a new timeline.
Exactly. Okay. The Melvin timeline.
The Melvin timeline. Okay.
So we're in the Melvin timeline and Star Trek the Motion Picture comes out. Would people like it? Would people still talk about it?
There's no Star Trek TV show beforehand at all. This is the first Star Trek in this Melvin universe.
The first thing is you see some aliens with crazy foreheads get killed, and then you see an angry guy get off a shuttle and saying, I'm taking over that ship.
I'm going to be totally honest.
Yeah.
I think that there would never have been another movie.
Yeah.
But the movie itself would be one of those great cult 70s films.
Like Silent Running.
Yes.
Or
Sorcerer or something like that has a passionate fan base of, you know, like people who are into strange 70s cinema.
Yeah.
Film nerds or just people who, you know, maybe if you enjoy watching films under the influence of certain substances. Right. I feel like we haven't touched on that, but I feel like Star Trek the Motion Picture would certainly be of a use to someone who does that.
Yeah, yeah, it's very colorful. I mean, even though it's beige on the interior, the swirly
those
blue
lights.
Those
trippy psychedelic V'ger sequences would really be fantastic.
Yeah.
For someone in that sort of headspace.
V'ger, yeah. Oh, you know what my two favorite moments in Star Trek the Motion Picture are? Is when Ilea, probe Ilea, so she's slow. And it's so funny, they mutated her voice electronically, and the actress was Indian, so she had a bit of an accent. So you could barely understand. I mean, this is not a negative. I'm just saying that I had trouble understanding her without the subtitles. Let's put it that way. But anyway, Ilea sees V'ger, slowly extends her hand, points, and says, V'ger. That's my number two favorite moment.
Okay.
My number one favorite moment, Ilea... very slowly raises her arm and points and says, V'ger. Happens twice from different angles.
That pretty much sums the movie up
pretty well. So wonderful.
The fact that it happens twice and the fact that we still like it.
It's so good. V'ger. So anyway, I think it would.
Give this movie a chance. That's my message.
Yeah.
Is don't expect The Wrath of Khan.
Right.
The Wrath of Khan exists and it's great. And open your minds and your hearts and let the motion picture in.
Yeah.
Give it a chance.
Like V'ger opened up and let the Spock, single Spock, and sucked him in his little aperture. Let the movie suck you in a tractor beam.
You might find you like it more than you did. I'm not saying it's a masterpiece, but I'm saying it's a worthwhile entry in the Star Trek pantheon.
And a very weird, specific type of 70s sci-fi. If you like it, then go chase down Andromeda Strain, which has a very similar look, and chase down, I mentioned Silent Runnings a few times, and others of that era, the Solaris, Tarkovsky Solaris, also interminably slow, but kind of fun. Tarkovsky's Stalker, which is not set in space, it's set in the zone. What are some others that you would compare it to?
I mean, the movie it feels the most like to me is 2001. I mean, not just the Trumbull effects, but just the idea of man going into outer space and connecting with this alien entity or presence or intelligence, and then spoiler alert for both, like that the outcome is this sort of merging of alien or computer technology and mankind to create this evolution or this idea, which is very kind of 60s and 70s of like, we need to evolve our consciousness, man, beyond the bounds of humanity, man, that kind of thing is present in both movies.
It's true, and 2001 is the better film, I think. I can admit that
For sure.
Even on the official Star Trek podcast, I can admit that 2001
is a
better film.
Very big of you.
But it would be, I mean, it's interesting to try to watch this movie and think about it if... It really, the concept of thinking about it as its own entity with no other Star Trek before or after struck me by watching that teaser trailer voiced by Orson Welles. Because it's such a spooky trailer with like the sound of warp engines revving up, and there's like quick cuts of the ship and the characters, and he says the names. And he presents them almost as if characters you don't know. William Shatner is Captain Kirk. George Takei is Lieutenant Sulu. And I was trying to put myself in the headspace of somebody who just never watched the show and what it would be like to come across it as this being the first. And I think it would really work. I think in a way you can approach it as the first. It's but also, and this is coming from Paramount this Christmas, imagine if you were a Star Trek fan. And you'd been in a drought for a decade, and you had the animated series, which was good. I like the animated series, but that's the animated series.
I liked it too as a kid.
And you've been reading the books, but you hadn't seen it. Let's say, you know, there was no internet back then, and unless you were tapped into Star Trek newsletters and, you know, were really going to conventions, you might have had no idea that Star Trek the Motion Picture was coming out, and you'd seen Star Wars, and you know you'd seen Close Encounters, and you'd be like, oh, you know, but my old favorite show, Star Trek, is still on reruns. And then you go to see a movie in early 1979. You go to see, I don't know, Any Which Way But Loose, the Clint Eastwood monkey movie, or whatever else was coming out in 1979. You go to see Kramer versus Kramer, or whatever it is, and the trailers are there, and you're sitting down, you're getting your popcorn, you're getting your milk duds. Maybe you're pouring your milk duds in your popcorn, like I like to do sometimes. And then you hear Orson Welles' voice, and you hear, no, it starts with the Paramount logo, and then the Paramount logo becomes like a wormhole, and then it goes,
damn wormholes.
And then
They're everywhere.
See like a light on what looks like the deflector dish. You're like, is that a deflector dish or the Enterprise? What's going on here? And then you hear William Shatner is Captain Kirk. What, you would have soiled yourself. You would have soiled yourself in the theater.
I would hope I wouldn't go that far.
I would
have
soiled myself.
Maybe you would have. Don't speak for me when it comes to soiling myself.
Imagine
please.
If you were, I mean, there probably are, I want to hear from listeners out there that didn't really know there was a movie coming out.
I would love to hear what the reaction, for fans who were there.
To that teaser trailer,
right. You know, what was, you know, like, because, you know, my experience in that line would be, sorry to mention Star Wars again, but like the Phantom Menace trailer, when that first appeared, people lost their minds.
But you knew it was coming.
You knew it was coming, that's true. But
I went to see Meet Joe Black.
Right, but I'd be curious, was there that much excitement around the trailer?
Oh,
you see what I'm saying? Was that as much of a phenomenon?
It's a very good, I would love to, yes, please leave a note on the Engage, the official Star Trek podcast Facebook page with your memories.
I'd love to read people's memories of seeing the first movie too, whether they, you know, liked it or hated it, how their opinions have changed over time, because certainly mine has, like I said.
Yeah.
This is a movie that I like more every time I see it.
Well, let's leave it on that then, with some fan engagement. Tweet at us. Use the EngagePod hashtag. You can tweet Matt Singer at Matt Singer.
Yep.
You should be reading Screen Crush every day. Check it for your movie news. And Matt is the editor-in-chief. He's also the principal critic. He does fun videos. I guess I could bring up some of the videos you do.
Well, people can just go to our YouTube channel and check them out.
Okay.
YouTube.com, /ScreenCrush.
I was going to say some of the things you're notorious for in video.
Oh, like when I eat horrible things, you mean? We don't need to get into that now.
Okay.
Let people discover that, much as the crew of the Enterprise discovered what was within V'ger. There are many layers to me, much like there are many layers to V'ger.
And layers, and Screen Crush, like the Enterprise, has a great crew. Great, you know, it's not just, it's not just Singer in the captain's seat. He's got his
Although my captain's seat does have the wings that fold down in case there's turbulence.
Right. He's got his own Scotty and Uhura and Bones. So tweet at us, leave us a message, contact us in all those places. And if you like the show, leave a go to iTunes and say nice things in a review. If you don't like the show, don't do anything. But if you like it, leave a review on iTunes. I want to say thanks again to Matt Singer for coming by.
My pleasure. The one thing you didn't say was the article that inspired us to have this conversation will be up at Screen Crush, too.
It's on Screen Crush. By the time you're hearing this, it's on Screen Crush, probably right front and center.
We talked about a lot of it, but there's other stuff we didn't mention, and there's some pictures and videos. Really...
It's dynamite.
It's complimentary to our conversation.
It's what inspired... I knew that Matt was doing it, and I'm like, you know what? That's a great thing to talk about before the madness of Star Trek Beyond is let's go back and look at the first movie before we look at... it's probably the last movie for a long time.
You think so?
I do. And that's not a bad thing. But I think that Star Trek Beyond is the last...
It's a trilogy.
It's a trilogy. I think the Kelvin timeline will be three movies. I'm not a fortune teller. I don't know this for sure. But, and then...
Well, at least we'll have the Melvin timeline down the line to carry forward. Right.
So 14. It'll be 14 movies. And then eventually it'll come back to movies. I mean, much like eventually it came back to TV. You know, it's in the... Or, you know, the next... It'll be like Pokemon Go. It'll be on alternate reality.
Who knows what the next thing will be.
It'll be like the Feelies.
Maybe the next Star Trek you will experience through a belt buckle that has no belt attached to it that you wear on your torso.
Belt buckle if we're lucky. All right. Well, listen, thanks again. And we'll see you next week.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.